Welcome to the Humble Hoof Podcast. My name is Alicia Harlov. This is a podcast for both horse owners and hoof care professionals, offering discussions into various philosophies on the health of the hoof and soundness of your horse. Please check us out on Facebook or at thehumblehoof.com. A few years ago, I had three UK farriers on the podcast, Robbie Richardson, Mark Johnson, and Matthew Jackson. And we talked about how they all left steel behind to go into a more holistic view of hoof care. And we chatted twice for the podcast, and the episodes were super popular and incredible conversations. So I invited them back on the podcast to talk about something that's really become a bit controversial and heated lately, and that is laminitis. We talk in this episode about the different ideas around laminitis that have been popping up, the triggers that we commonly see for laminitis, and how we approach it in our hoof care and treatment plans. Well, thank you so much for being willing to join me again and chat about some different hoof care things. I know that the last two conversations we've had were some of the most popular in the podcast. It's been so great to learn from all of you and have the chance to talk to you again. And I know that some people may not have heard those episodes. So I'll put links to those so that people can hear them. But if we can go around and maybe give a brief intro into who you are, how you got into hoof care, that kind of thing. That would be great. And I don't know if Matthew wants to start.
Yeah, sure. So Matthew Jackson, I live on the west coast of Scotland, served my time from the age of 16, up in the north of Scotland, spent time in England, the northeast, traveled around a bit, Aberdeenshire. I went there for a few years as well. And I'm 50 now. Technically retired, so I'm a gentleman farrier. Basically, I'm a quiet observer of the world of shoeing and barefoot, shall we say.
Great. Yeah. And Robbie?
Okay, I'm Robbie Richardson. I'm now, 71. I'm still working with horses. I did my apprenticeship back in the day, and I experimented with lots of other types of shoe. I wanted to see about cold shoeing and other things, and then settled on the fact that I loved working on corrective work, and so took myself back to school, basically, and then eventually opened up Greatcombe Clinic, and that was remedial work. But 28 years ago, drove my last nail and went 100% barefoot. So for 28 years now, just been doing barefoot and boots. And along with Mark Johnson, you're about to hear from, we've opened up a thing called Hoof Boot Farriers. So we're training people about boots.
Oh, that's great. Awesome. I've seen a bit about that, but I'd love to hear more about that at some point. That's awesome. Yeah. And Mark?
Hi, Alicia. It's lovely to be back here again. Thank you very much. My name's Mark Johnson. I'm based in the middle of the UK, literally. And I guess I first picked up the first horse's foot when I was 14 to actually do some work on it, obviously under guidance, etc. Then school holidays, then apprenticeship, and trained as a traditional farrier. Always asking questions and always not necessarily satisfied with the answers I was getting. So then, cutting a long story short, through getting very, very interested in anatomy and biomechanics, I morphed away from steel, and we did that great podcast on leaving steel behind. And now I focus entirely on barefoot, then supported by boots, and then, if necessary, composite shoes. And it doesn't make me anti-steel. It just means it's a personal choice not to use it. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, I talked about this with Matthew last week, is that, I the more I learn, the less I am anti anything. I'm sort of pro horse. But that being said, I feel like lately I've become more and more passionate about laminitic issues and treatments and approaches, just because I feel like there's some controversial or even, a bit volatile statements just passed around on social media. And I would love to talk a little bit about laminitis today. Hopefully we won't get too controversial or crazy, but I think it's something that the general public could use some good insight into, that has some credibility and, evidence-based information. So if you're all up for it, I would love to talk about that today.
Sounds good.
Great. Great.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So in terms of your hoof care, you know, journeys and your businesses, do you all see a lot of laminated cases? Is that something that's pretty common in what you come across, or what's your main like body of casework that you work on?
Who's going first? will we do the round robin?
Whoever wants to go. Yeah, it's totally fine.
I mean, laminitis, when I was learning and stuff, was predominantly, dare I say, it was old horses. You know, unless it was poisoning or anything like that, it was, you know, it was never that much of a big deal. But when it was, there was a lot of excitement, get down to the vets and do an awful lot of observing others, really. That was like my apprenticeship upbringing and things. What was interesting through my when I was shoeing in the early days and things, I'm not saying I was the go-to guy, but I did a lot of laminatics, an awful lot. But at the time, the crossover was, I was starting to do an awful lot of the sort of barefoot side, and what the barefoot side was kind of teaching you, and what you are finding out very, 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 very quickly, was actually it was gut health that we had an awful lot of issues with, and also the type of farms we had that they were turning over to horse livery and things like that was predominantly for fattening animals up. So it was, yeah, classic. It was, you know, it was ryegrass and clover. So our climate's not very great, because every time it rains, there's a sugar spurt. So you were starting to see an awful lot more of that. But it was interesting doing the barefoot stuff, because the first thing that we had to do was try and get a better hoof capsule to grow out. And very, very early on, the use of pre and probiotics supporting the liver, that there became the absolute stable benchmark. And what you were able to do, you were able to kind of minimize little impacts that the horses were having. And, you know, it's not just as simple as that. You know, it was part of a package of these. I mean, these guys had to be ridden, had to be exercised an awful lot. And that was part of the sort of the barefoot sort of journey at that kind of point, you know. We did it. I can remember being invited going down to North Yorkshire with a bunch of trimmers and a bunch of vets and things. And this was quite early on in my career. And we sat around a table and we discussed laminitis. And at the end of it, we kind of all came to the conclusion that actually we knew nothing about it. And that an awful lot of traditional type stuff that we'd all learned just wasn't cutting the mustard at that point. So we did, was me and a lady that I did a lot of research with. We went and got as many different papers as we possibly could. There was about 24. And we systematically just went through them, looking at the research that had been done, but taking out points that were able to cross-reference with the rest of the papers. And very, very early on, it was like, right, okay, we need to stabilize the gut. We have to maintain an alkaline pH within these guys. So again, that kind of package was put together for our laminitic horses. So at that point, I started getting well away from laminitis. I kind of de-skilled myself a wee bit because I wasn't seeing a lot of them. But when I was getting involved, it was, you know, it was mainly poisoning, it was, you know, retaining afterbirth, that kind of stuff. So that protocol was very, very different. Off the back of that, did have a handful of horses, but they were EMS horses, so they were, you know, you were just constantly just trying to keep them comfortable, sort of thing. So that's kind of my sort of background to laminitis and bits and bobs.
That's so interesting that you saw fewer EMS cases. Like, it sounds like that wasn't the primary cause that you were seeing.
Well, what we were doing was, it was very much so about regulating grass intake, so it was sugar. But it was, you know, the worse the ground was, the more the horse had to exercise. Yeah. And again, this is not me. This is horse owners trying to get ahead of this and trying to understand it that little bit more. You know, a lot of the ones that I ended up just maintenance trimming, for example, they were, you know, they'd had it for years, mainly hormonal issues, really, when you get into it, and cushions, that kind of stuff. But what was interesting, if you got a call because something was looking a bit footy, and that was the worry that was what was happening with it, it was, I mean, the same protocol was the sort of same, you know, liver tonics, detoxing them, and, you know, pre and probiotics and double dosing them, and just kind of trying to recover the gut as quickly as possible to try and minimize the impact on the shot.
Yeah. And Robbie and Mark, have you seen, or did you see similar? And I know that I'm sure that things have changed so much. I know that even in the time, I've only been in hoof care 10 years and things have changed so much in terms of what we know about laminitis, but what sort of triggers have you seen over your careers, and what would you say is like the most common cause that you noticed, or do you work on a lot of laminitis cases? I should even ask that.
Who are we going to go with? Robbie, do you want to take it and then I'll jump in?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's just go back on my history with laminitis. I opened the clinic in 1984 and my living was made out of laminitis. It was me and Rob Eustace and a couple of other people who were doing things like the resections, which had come across from the States. I was performing an amazing amount of these and putting on plastic shoes. And these were all referral cases, because over here, legally wise, it was far better to work. So I was called a referral farrier. So every case I did was from a vet. But what we started, listening to Matthew, it's very interesting because he's there talking about a lot of internal things going on. Let's first of all, if we can, and I know it's not, we don't want to be controversial, but let's agree on something that we don't know, not only what laminitis is, but we are actually calling things laminitis that aren't laminitis. I mean, capsular rotation is not laminitis, unless you want to say any deviation of the white line is laminitis, in which case, fine, everything is laminitis. And so we'll start from there. It was a huge living for me. I was performing these wonderful miracles. I was getting horses very comfortable. I was learning very much ha-ha on the hoof, but we were performing resections that we didn't need to do. We were then doing what we call porthole surgery to release serum. We were getting horses very comfortable, but these were internal problems like Matthew was just talking about. But do you know what? I suppose a third of mine were actually horses that I didn't think had laminitis. They actually needed a radical foot care, but they weren't ones where internally they had the problems that maybe Matthew was talking about. And it wasn't until 28 years ago when I stopped driving nails that I realized the integrity of the white line is sacred. I have a particular beef about the terminal lamini, and I could do a whole talk on the terminal lamini, because that to me is where the foot has to have its integrity, regardless of how it's all produced. And I realized very early doors that a lot of the cases that were being referred to me were being talked about as being laminitic. And I think whatever word we come up with for them, if we're going to lump in the ones that Matthew's talking about and all the internal problems that, of course, we come across, they're sure as hell different from the ones that we were seeing and we're talking about nowadays with certain people that are using, I think, capsule rotation as an excuse to say they're curing laminitis. And we're talking about getting back to basic balance. And that's probably where I am now and having to be, because I'm no longer a god with a shoe. I'm now relying on the horse to tell me how it wants to be kicked into the healing process so they can get on with it itself.
Yeah.
My world, I guess, somewhat parallels Matthew's, I think, to a degree. Now, do I see a lot of laminitic cases? I don't, in fairness, but the ones I do see are usually quite bad. I think I hope I ascribe a lot of that to client communication. So, I mean, I'm probably a complete pain in the backside to a lot of them, in fairness, because, you know, I'm continuously talking about weather changes. I'm continuously talking about hay changes and the like. So keeping it at the forefront of people's minds, I think, is a strong element of trying to combat this in the first place. And I suppose to answer your original question in what do I see the most of, and it would be endocrinopathic cases for sure. The most notorious cases I think I work on is around poisoning. Now, when I say poisoning, I'm going to bring medication into that, because as far as the actual system is concerned, if a horse has received a medication, a chemical or whatever, as far as the horse's system is concerned, that could potentially be an assault on its metabolism. So we will see a reaction. I mean, I'm very, very hot on talking to people about EMS, and the, you know, if the word steroids comes into the equation, then we pretty much know that a steroid injection is possible for that to create a serious insulin spike in an EMS horse. So we want to be thinking about their state beforehand and have a, you know, be able to have an open discussion and so on and so forth. I do think that I have experienced, though I can't be sure about it, but I think I've experienced several cases where local crop spraying has drifted and horses have become incredibly sick, incredibly sore very, very quickly. Like I say, I can't swear to that, but it kind of points to that. And the subsequent repair of the horse's system has been incredibly challenging to get those back on their feet again. I'm very much a case of, I totally agree in terms of liver tonics and trying to keep the horse's biome as healthy as possible, the digestion as healthy as possible. And I feel very strongly that unless we can really identify and get hold of these triggers, we have a far slimmer chance of being able to make improvement, you know, when we come across these. So finding that trigger and being able to deal with that trigger, whether that is environmental or whether it's management of specifics or looking at feed, etc. It fascinates me a lot as well why people get so engrossed in patterns of feeding horses. You know, like we have a varied diet, so why would we not kind of give a horse a varied diet as well? We get very, very fixated for long periods of time, potentially, if we don't sort of reevaluate and have a think, is this still working for us? But yeah, so the only one that I'm struggling, I've been racking my brains to think, do I see any supporting limb laminitis? And I don't think I've seen very many cases of that at all. So that's, you know, that's kind of where I'm at in my world, I think. But the main thing is that communication, keeping the education at the forefront, keeping people reminded. You know, at the moment in the UK, sort of middle of the UK anyway, we're like the Gobi Desert. Well, you can guarantee the minute we get a proper dump of rain, the colic cases will go up and the laminitic cases will go up. And it's just preempting that for people, making sure they're focused.
Yeah, and I would say that I'm similar in terms of, I think because now I'm not really picking up new clients, and the ones that I've worked with have heard from me incessantly about management and the importance of, you know, diet, exercise, gut health, all those things. I don't tend to see a lot of active laminitis cases unless I'm taking them on to my books as a new client. And yeah, I would say in that case, like you, I see the most of the ones I see are endocrinopathic. But I have had one case of SIRS, or systemic inflammatory response syndrome, due to a liver infection, and one case of supporting limb due to a very bad superficial digital flexor tendon tear, where the mare just would not pick up her other foot months, just would not lift it. And so those cases, I think, like you were saying, they're kind of standout dramatic cases because they can be catastrophic. They're so difficult. And sort of the EMS cases now that I work on, or the PPID cases, they're less like, you know, frontline news or headline news, because it's sort of, you know what's causing it, you address what's causing it, and the horse ideally gets better. And it's less, I mean, obviously, it's always anxiety ridden if you have a horse that's sore. But typically now we know more about how to help them, and it can definitely take troubleshooting. But I did have one question for Robbie, because you had mentioned that, you know, and I agree. I think that maybe we don't need to label everything as laminitis. But I tend to, maybe I'm just misunderstanding what you're saying, or maybe we have totally different opinions, which is totally fine, is that I tend to think, a lot of people think that if a horse, you know, has a broken forward hoof pastern access, or if they have high angles, they think that there's something wrong, or that they're rotated or whatever. And I tend to think that that can be more of a conformational issue or a trim issue. Whereas if I see that the coffin bone is no longer aligned with the dorsal wall, or if there's a thicker, you know, horn lamellar zone, or if that to me says that I'm worried there's inflammation in that lamina area or a breakdown of that lamina. And that, and of course, I'm gauging it on how painful the horse is too. You know, if the horse is painful and I'm seeing that, then I'm worried that that's more like an active laminitis case. And I'm wondering if I'm saying the opposite of what you are. And that's totally fine because you have a lot more experience than I do. So I'm not trying to argue with you. I'm just wondering if we could clarify that too.
No, I would say we're actually talking very much the same, because I would say most of the ones that were sent to me for what I was classifying as capsular rotation, these horses weren't in pain. These were horses where there might be something biomechanically going on, and the query of the vet made them take an x-ray, and they would then draw lots of lines on the x-ray saying, do you see how rotated this is? And I would see that the capsule had got away from it, but mainly through bad management, not what I would be calling a horse in pain with laminitis. And the laminitic wedge, if allowed to go out, and if you didn't do a supportive management of these feet, then subsequently you can get secondary effects even through, I think, the neglect and the capsule rotation. But I agree with you that the first signs were that, and that I would worry that it was obviously something more serious going on, and you would start to look internally. I suppose really my first statement was about, are we first of all agreeing what laminitis is in its variants, and getting it down to a smaller number of variants than it seems to be at the moment. I mean, it amazes me what I'm getting referred to as laminitis. I do think, well, like Mark and like Matthew, really, my criteria is let's first of all see what this horse is eating, how much it's moving, and movement to me is everything, but movement with the correct diet, you know, and that's getting the owner on board. And we have to try and simplify it as professionals. Often, no matter how complex our understanding is and our research is, we all know that at the end of the day, we have to simplify it so that owners are coming with us on this, because otherwise we're going to get nowhere. But no, in reply to you, Alicia, I agree. I think we're both singing off the same page.
Yeah, and I think that all three of you mentioned movement and or exercise. And something that I've noticed is that the horses that are, I know this sounds, I don't know if this sounds wrong, but the horses that are ridden the most, and obviously I know that we can talk about ethics of riding and, you know, are horses equipped to carry people? That's a whole nother conversation. But the horses that I see that are ridden the most and exercise the most tend to have the best feet, even if they don't have the best management in other ways. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And I've seen horses where I'm like, you should not have such nice feet. Like, you know, they're eating like things that I would never feed my horses. And their feet are so good because their owners are, you know, it's like having any other animal. You're exercising it and you're giving the care it needs and the species appropriate movement it needs, and their feet are better for it. And I've seen, I think this is what you were referencing for both Matthew and Robbie, is that I've seen horses that previously had extensive hoof issues or laminitis have a much healthier hoof grow in simply from exercise and movement. And I think that may be a little bit of a segue into my question, or what I want to talk about next is, I know, or I hope that we all know that the hoof care, or what we do to the feet, is very important, and the trim is very important. But I personally don't think that the trim itself is the be-all, end-all, because I've seen horses that are trimmed in very different ways that end up with healthier feet just from changing their exercise or their movement, or just from changing their diet. And that's not throwing away the trim or what we do to their feet. I think that's exceptionally important, and we can very much harm a hoof or horse with a poor trim. And I don't want to, you know, try to dismiss that at all. But I don't know if you have seen, or any of you have seen similar, where you have a variance in how you're approaching a horse's hooves and other factors are playing maybe a bigger role? Or am I totally out there in that?
Can I come in on this? So,
yeah.
So my observations thus far was that, again, what I said to you the other week, you know, feet have to develop from birth. So there's this requirement of strong internal integrity within the hoof capsule. Now, what I always observed was when you had a significant event line happen, in horses with very, very well developed feet, it didn't make any impact on the horse whatsoever. It might be footy, it cut it just a little bit off, but very quickly it would move on. Horses with very underdeveloped feet, so we're talking again where digital cushion's the best sort of, for me, is the best sort of point of squeezing that and having a good sort of feel. Contracted heels, these structures that have not developed correctly, these subtle event lines start creating hoof capsule distortion. And the more the regular this insult happens, as the hoof capsule starts growing down, you start losing integrity at the bottom. So what you've got is you've got flat feet, you've got stretch white line, you've got all these sorts of things. And my conclusion in amongst all this was that obviously we'll have an ideal as best we can within domestication, but also we've got a very extreme of what doesn't work. And these underdeveloped feet, they don't work. So seasonal and environmental hits on them are catastrophic to them. And we know this because they'll go footy and the hoof capsule will distort. Now, it's interesting what Robbie's saying, because I think it's a fantastic point that I think we really need to be looking at is that laminitis? What is the definition of laminitis? Because when I was a young lad learning, laminitis was very clear cut. It was very obvious, this is what laminitis is. But also as well, you only ever saw thin-hoofed horses on, let's say, well-bred thoroughbreds. Every other horse kicking about, because they were there to have a job, to work hard, and they weren't pasture pets, these guys had predominantly good feet.
Yeah.
So the question for me is what we're seeing within our environment, so we have a flush of grass. Every horse in my area, if it rained in that area, would throw out an event line. We used to mark and measure feet and things like that. We would see a significant heel contraction. And from the tip of the frog, the sole, we would get a distance would start increasing on that. But the very good feet would recover from that within 2 to 3 weeks. So what you've got there is you've got a horse adapting to the insult that's happening to it. Now, whether that's their need for it to create better circulation, which in turn promotes better lymphatic movement, which is where healing process within my horses, getting rid of those damaged cells. And again, for me, again, my observations was, it was like horses' feet have 9 lives. Hmm. They can cope with this, they can cope with it, they can cope with it, and then they stop being able to cope with it. And then if you lose the integrity of the hoof capsule, these, you know, let's say just grass, because like EMS is like the biggest thing kicking about at the moment and stuff, that was catastrophic for them. So it's interesting. Is it laminitic or has it just lost the hoof capsule integrity whereby we've got movement of papillae, we've got inflammation and we've got swelling? So again, it's not clear cut because every horse is different, every environment's different and their upbringings are very, very different. You know, the favorites are the ones that either get hammered in the field, horses kick them. But then if that's happening, then the horse is kicking them, basically saying, this horse is sick. I don't want you anywhere near us. Or you've got like worming now is catastrophic. Do you know what I mean? That has a massive insult on these guys, you know? And certain horses will recover very quickly from it. So some of them take a very, very long time for it to recover from them. Now, for me, again, talked about this last week. To me, the best way to get rid of to take a horse out of a herd dynamic and environment is to hit it in the feet. Slow it down, make it foot sore, something's going to come along and catch it and eat it. That, to me, is disease control. So then taking those principles and laying them into domestication, these guys don't have natural predators within domestication. So you're not
that removal isn't happening. But if the foot starts recovering and it gets a little bit better, bump, then you have another insult from weather or whatever else. So you're constantly fatiguing the structural integrity of the laminae of the hoof capsule, which then in turn creates a cascade effect of all the other structures that are adjoining to it. So again, it's this topic is not straightforward. You know, you talked about conformation as well. You know, heel height's interesting. Heel height and the taking down of heels to the widest part of the frog, that's for the application of a horseshoe. I've never ever seen, like, my barefoot horses that were working 24/7, and, you know, I had a lot of them. I was trimming nearly 250 guys, you know, and I mean, a good, you know, 2/3 of them were in a lot of work. Their heels never sat at the widest point of the frog, you know? So if you take that and then think about the internals and you lift a foot up and you start palpate and moving around the pedal joint, every horse has a limited range of movement within that. Do you know what I mean? You know, so it has to be horse by horse. It has to be case by case. But I definitely agree with Robbie. It's like what is laminitis now? You know, it's we've drifted so far away from the mark. But I think the reason why this is happening is because our environments are so much more toxic now. You know, modern farming, you know, fungicides, you know, antibacterial sprays, whatever. You know, they are rife within our countrysides. Plus, our horses are bumming around on grass that actually gives cattle laminitis. Mm. Most of the original laminitis research was done on cows. So you've got, you know, and then it progressed into horses. The more people were able to start purchasing them, start become a, you know, a kind of lifestyle choice more to have horses rather than a certain group of folk, you know. So again, you know, we have to be very specific going forward. What actually are we dealing with here? Because if you don't get to the root cause of whatever the trigger is, how are you going to prevent that and then stabilize the horse and allow it to repair?
Yeah. And I think something that really has been difficult for me to see pop up are the ideas that, you know, I'm seeing similar to what you're talking about, is that I feel like I can turn on and turn off hoof issues based on the management and the diet and the movement and the stress of the animal and the illness or health or anything like that. And I won't even change anything to how I'm approaching the feet. And I can see comfort or discomfort show up based on everything else in that horse's life. And what I'm struggling with seeing is that people saying that, well, if you have a specific trim, or if you have the hoof in balance, quote unquote, or the right trim, then it doesn't matter what other factors are in the horse's life because they're going to be fine because the foot's in balance. And granted, I haven't necessarily decided to then experiment with that. You know, I'm not going and changing my trim and then tossing all these insults at the horse to see what happens, because ethically, and I think a lot of us around this issue believe that ethically we're obviously doing what we believe is right for the horse, and we don't want to change that to risk any of this going wrong. But ethically, I'm not going to, you know, do something that I think could harm a foot because I want to prove a point, basically. And I think none of us want to do that. But that's something that I know that you all have seen. I think you can't be in hoof care or even really in the horse world with any kind of knowledge of feet without seeing this idea that the trim is going to allow you to be able to feed the horse anything, or, you know, have the horse encounter any kind of issue and they won't become laminitic or won't founder or won't rotate if you have this unicorn perfect trim. I don't know if any of you want to chime in on that. And I'd love to. Yeah. Yeah.
I'd love to for my Alicia.
Yeah.
Because really, really where you're going with this is the emphasis on lowering the heels and letting the toe elongate somewhat. That's basically what where you're going, I'm assuming. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, for a start off, before we even get there, when we come along and trim a foot, what we're doing is we're basically changing that horse's environment. So The foot has evolved to whatever it is, whatever it is, literally in that horse's environment. And then we come along and we make a change to that. So as far as the horse is concerned, something has made a quite dramatic change within its own lifestyle, if you like. So, and that will depend on obviously how much foot we're removing and the trim cycle, etc. So that's one element to this. But I'm just gonna go into what has, if I may anyway,
yeah.
I'm gonna go into what has interested me the most about this. Because what I really struggle to ignore are the voices that say that my horse has been so much better as a result of having a much more elongated toe and the heels lowered. And that does interest me. And the only sort of way that I can personally think about this, and I'll be delighted if somebody else can come up with something. I enjoy doing a lot of slow motion photography of horses in motion at ground level, parallel to them when I'm working on them. You know, I get a lot out of that. And if we take the hoof capsule in a health, let's just for argument's sake, in inverted commas, say in a healthy state. So in a healthy state of movement, the hoof will come in somewhat posteriorly first, take up the initial contact, it will come through it, it will load, and then it will roll through its toe and take off again. Okay. In these situations where it's claimed that the more elongated toe has made the horse far more comfortable than anything else ever has, what's actually happening here? Because when the horse comes in, one is assuming, because like I said, I don't have definitive footage of this. It's very hard for me to be able to get it. But if the foot comes in and lands flat, which it's probably going to do, the horse begins to move forward with the opposing limb. And as it's moving forward with the opposing limb, which is in the air, the cannon bone of the weight-bearing limb begins to move forward across the top of the hoof capsule. Okay. Now, in a healthy horse, the stride progresses, the pastons become engaged. The pastons will uniformly move forwards and above the pedal bone, and they will begin to load at the front aspect of the pedal joint prior to breakover. Okay. Now, at that point, there is quite a lot of load coming on to that hoof capsule. So if we have a hoof capsule which is compromised and we have a laminal bond which is breaking down, there's a lot of inflammation there. If we trim that toe hard off and we facilitate that movement, what we're asking the horse to do is directly engage with that compromised laminae. If we allow that toe to really elongate, we prevent those pastons physically being able to come forward and through into the full articulatory position of the pedal bone. And then the articulation has to then be taken up with both the knee joint and the shoulder. So we're getting a situation whereby the horse isn't really breaking over, but it's lifting up and over its feet. So it actually disengages a proportion of that natural movement. Okay. This is, again, my thoughts. I'm not telling anybody this is fact. It's just the way I've been thinking about this. So with that disengagement, the horse actually, now, because it has to do something else, has become somewhat more fluid and comfortable, in inverted commas. The other question mark to this is that with that toe distension, we know, generally speaking, that the laminae across the ungular cartilages or the lateral cartilages is, generally speaking, in a healthier state than the laminae that's further forward. In that case, that laminae is actually having to do an awful lot of work in terms of its attachment, etc. Does, question mark, that elongated toe now, because it's integral with the whole foot and it's intertwined with the whole foot, is it acting as scaffolding for that hoof capsule? Okay. So is any of this making sense so far?
Yeah. No, I know what you're saying. And I have follow-up questions, but I want you to keep going and then I'll ask.
Cool. All right. Okay, so again, speculatively, is that creating a bracing through that hoof capsule? Now, if any of that's correct, if any of it is correct, it is why people, I think, are perceiving with some horses, not all, but some horses are going, in inverted commas, more comfortably and are coping with life better because of it. Now, there's no free pill here, you know, because the first question that you need to really step back from and ask is, why is my horse better off with deformed feet than with feet that aren't deformed? Why? And you have to acknowledge the fact that these feet are deformed in what to whatever degree that's occurred. So in my brain cell, it's not the answer. The answer, I think we were given the answer years back now, with the likes of Pete Ramey, with the likes of Daisy Bicking, basically getting the leverage off the hoof capsule and getting some vertical depth underneath, because what all of this does, all of this distortion will do, is we will lose sole depth quite spectacularly. Now, sole depth is incredibly important for the protection of the base of the pedal bone and circulation beneath the pedal bone as well. And also the protection of the bones. So if we can then reinstate some capsular depth on something that's dynamic, and I absolutely love squish pads, really adore them because they are dynamic. The foot has got no control over being able to destroy that squish pad other than posturally. So it's always got that level of protection, and it's always got that invitation to restore circulation. And it allows that horse to elevate in its heel if it wishes to, and if it wishes to compress in its heel, it's able to. So that sort of dynamic intervention is, to my brain cell, where farriery really, really scores and comes through for the horse. I'll shut up now.
No, I want to say, I absolutely understand what you're saying in terms of the horse is changing its movement when they have a distorted hoof capsule, and that might look like they're willing to extend more or land differently or move more comfortably because they have to actually adjust and adapt their entire movement base and biomechanics because of that.
Yep.
And I will say, you know, I'm not afraid to admit, and I've talked to people about this before, that I do have some horses that have thinner soles or laminitic issues who I choose to leave a little bit more toe on, because if I know the owner can't reliably boot or the barn can't reliably boot, or, you know, if I know the horse's environment and I want to make sure that I'm not risking them being uncomfortable until I head back there next. I have seen some horses that do seem more comfortable, and I will on any lamellar wedge or any horse with a significant lamellar wedge, I will go past the quote unquote inner hoof wall. I don't know, you know, it's migrated so much that I don't even want to call it the inner hoof wall anymore, because when we have a lamellar wedge, the landmarks have distorted to the point where
absolutely they have distorted. Yes.
Yeah, you can't really say, well, this is where the wall should be, because it's not.
Can I just very quickly jump in on that one?
Yeah,
Alicia. Sorry to interrupt you there, but if you're talking about the inner wall, you can keep rasping and rasping and rasping and rasping, and the inner wall is still there, so it's not a landmark that we can really take in, you know, because it's an anatomical structure. It's part of the structure of the hoof wall, and it's going to be there unless you strip the whole lot out. So
right.
I mean,
basically, like what you're saying is that, you know, as the foot grows, that's going to naturally migrate forward anyway. And so as we take it down, it's going to naturally migrate back. It's part of the hoof structure, you know, unless you're going to trim down to the coffin bone, which I hope nobody would.
Yep.
So there are horses where I do leave, like if somebody saw a picture of some of the feet that I work on with a horse that has thinner soles, I'm sure some people would be like, oh my goodness, you're leaving a long toe. When we're looking at the center of rotation, when we're looking at the widest part of the foot, there might be more hoof ahead of that I'm choosing as a temporary, temporary, not meaning like 9 months temporary, temporary meaning like this hoof cycle, this trim cycle, I am temporarily making this choice.
But Alicia, you're demonstrating evaluative dynamic thinking, aren't you? So it's not a one size fits all. It's a where's this individual horse at, and what can I do at this moment for this individual horse? And you won't necessarily apply that to the next horse. It's, like I say, evaluative thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and I would love anybody else to chime in here too, is that I apply that same thing when I'm looking at founder cases, when I'm considering lowering heels, because I understand that, oh gosh, this is such a huge thing. And it's not even just you know, amongst the barefoot crowd of like, how much should we trim the heels? It is, as you all know, in the farrier world, the approach to laminitis is so widely different. We have people that are putting on ultimate wedges and putting up, you know, 20 degree wedges on horses to get what, you know, what they want is more circulation. And then we're, you know, I tend to lean more in the camp of, I want to get that coffin bone off its tip. I want to lower the palmar angle, but I want to do it in a way that is not going to cause damage to a deep digital flexor tendon or a check ligament, because that horse is so painful and so restricted and so tense that if I chop all this heel off right now, then, and I will say I have seen a mini, it was not trimmed by me, who the owner was pushing the farrier to lower the heels because they read online, and I'm not even joking, they read online that their mini was foundered because the heels were not being trimmed. And so the farrier trimmed down the heels, and that mini damaged its check ligaments, knuckled over at the fetlock, and they never got that horse back. And within a few months, they tried so many different things. They tried, you know, like botulism injections, like all these things to try to relax these muscles and get this fetlock back to where it was in a healthy state. They ended up having to euthanize this mini. And so I have that case, you know, I was called in to try to help, you know, I have that case in my mind. And so my thought when I approach any case, any horse, but really in founder cases, is what can this horse handle at this point to get them to a point where they are comfortable and their foot is growing healthier?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I don't know if anybody else wants to comment on that, because I'm rambling.
I better shut up, but can I just say one last thing that I wanted to in there? I'll ask you this, on a healthy x-ray, how many deep digital flexor tendons could you easily see on a healthy x-ray? And when you put that DDFT under some serious tension, it's scary how pronounced that becomes.
Yeah.
The tensile strain on those tendons can be something incredible. And the definition on some of these x-rays is phenomenal. Now I will shut up because I wanted to say that. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. No, I appreciate it. But yeah, I don't know if anybody else want to chime in about toe length or heel lowering or cases or what you do in terms of the trim.
I don't have much skin in the game anymore. So I'm going to say this. I think aesthetically, what people perceive to be a healthy foot and the need for it to aesthetically look in a certain way is causing an awful lot of these issues and challenges. You know, every event line will create a distortion of hoof capsule migrating forward, whether it's large, small, doesn't make any difference. That hoof capsule it's got a weak spot and it's running forward. Now then, as a farrier, what you can do is bring the foot forward, and we're all very good at making them look pretty and making them look symmetrical based on what we define as symmetrical. So what you're actually doing is you're rasping flare off, is what you're doing. Flare has to be looked at very, very carefully. You know, certainly if it's, you know, I'm not talking major lateral flare here, but I'm talking toe flare, because that part of the foot has to be incredibly strong. Now, I was a natural balance farrier. I was the only shoe I used. So, you know, you didn't have clips. You didn't have those sorts of things kicking about. But what you had to be very observant of is as flare started to grow out, you never ever addressed that unless it was at least 2/3 down the bottom of the foot, because you lost structural integrity. But then if you have guys fitting clips, for example, a clip, if you put a clip right on the edge of the front of that foot, that shoe's too far forward. So what they'll do is they'll cut a wee recess into it and then they'll rasp back to that. But what they're not addressing is how much of integral strength are you losing? Now in shoes, because we nail them and things like that, you're creating stability there, but it's false stability. It's not hoof capsule stability. So we got a question, really, when we have feet that are looking gnarly and they've had an awful lot of issues and things like that, don't be straight in and don't be pressured into getting them looking nice and pretty again. Because the hoof capsule has to grow this stuff out, and it grows it out in a way that it's desperately trying to retain biomechanical strength. Now, the next issue with these heels
what we're constantly doing when we're in these scenarios is we've done an x-ray, we've had a look, and there is pressure there because we want that pedal bone to be in a certain position. But what nobody's asking here is, what does the horse want? Where is the horse at with its comfort level? Because we know what's it at with its healing level. And this all has to do with the surfaces that the animal's moving around on. Because of its very, very firm, flat surfaces, that horse cannot elevate, mechanically elevate itself naturally, as we've seen many do, and Bowker talked about it extensively, for to then start moving circulation around when the limb is at rest. You know, horses dynamically have to move all the time for the lymphatic system to work properly. So now what we've got is an animal that doesn't want to move around particularly well. So Mother Nature's put in a little wee gadget there where it says, right, okay, we stomp your toes into the ground, elevate your heels, and I'll allow a percentage of increase in circulation. Now, the next issue I've got is this heel chopping, taking heels down, heels down, heels down. Exactly what Mark says. You've got a deep digital flexor tendon there that's saying, actually, I can't do this. But you've also got a hoof capsule. The joint itself has a certain orientation of movement that varies between each and every horse. Now, if you whack that down so far, that horse needs to elevate. All that pressure is going on the extensor processor of the pedal bone. You know?
Yeah.
So our next question is, we've got to ask ourselves, when horses are going through a crisis, why is it that they're trying to elevate themselves? Now, are they being prevented from elevating for the circulatory reasons because the surface isn't correct? Because when you think about it, these animals, they're mechanically, physically damaging themselves to try and get themselves in a certain position. And I don't have the answers for this. This is just all hypothetical. It's based on observation. But taking something that's a crisis point and not respecting the process of healing that has to happen over a period of time, what we do if we're applying something to the foot, we're setting it in a position that we think it will be happy with. And you either get it right, but if you get it wrong, it's catastrophic.
Can I just say that every conformable clog I've ever put on an acute case, every single one bar none where the horse has had autonomy has been put into a wedge by the horse. Yep. Not by me, but by the horse.
Yeah.
And I've seen the same, even just putting horses on like a gym mat or a Surefoot pad, if they're in, you know, a crisis or laminitic issue, typically I see a lot of them that want to dig their toes in. I mean, if you have a horse that's really leaning back, like they're foundering so badly and they're leaning back, you know, I have some that have that founder stance. But if it's a more subtle case, I'll say that I don't know any horses that I put on Surefoot pads, except maybe a small handful out of probably 100 at this point that I put on Surefoot pads, they typically want to elevate their palmar angle given the chance. And you know,
within a time frame,
right?
Within a time frame, very specific time frame, you know, and it's given them within the rehab set, and it's given them the option to choose that position themselves.
Yeah,
you know, if you go to, you know, my experience, you know, veterinary clinics that did an awful lot of this, they had concrete floors and had rubber matting. Do you know what I mean? A little bit of shaving just to pick up the wee and whatnot, but predominantly it's a sterile rubber mat. Well, that rubber mat at times there was no giving it really. So the horses stood static for exceptionally long lengths of time when they're designed to move. And now what you've got is an animal desperately fighting against what it's standing on to try and get itself into a position where it can start healing itself. And again, this is where now the internet and all this sort of stuff, everybody's got an opinion. I have an opinion from my silo and my observations. Are they right? Are they wrong? I don't know. You know, I got some right. I got the odd one wrong, you know. But, you know, we have to really step back from this and start thinking about, right, this has had a crisis point. Okay, we're going to put it back where Mother Nature intended it in its perfect state when it's healthy. We're not taking into account, what are we doing to it because it's not healthy? This horse is in crisis. Where does it need to have this foot? And more importantly, when it comes to toes, for example, you know, modern farriery, You know, we trim them, we rasp them back, we make them look pretty. So what are we doing? We're removing material to mask flaring and distortions. You know, but what you're actually doing is you're destabilizing part of the hoof capsule that needs to be exceptionally rigid.
Yeah. And I will say, and I want to preface this with, I do not make any money from Surefoot pads or you know, the Murdoch method, but I do have, my veterinarian has the radiograph box, the soft radiograph box from, you know, Surefoot Equine, and they allow the horse to stand on these radiograph blocks and basically shift their weight the way that they are comfortable or they want to in that moment. And I'm not saying that that moment in time is what the horse will always want or, you know, even wants, you know, an hour later, but it's very interesting to have a horse, you know, get radiographs on hard, firm radiograph blocks and what they are forced to sort of deal with on their everyday, in their everyday life on a firm surface, and then put them on soft blocks and see how they shift their weight and how some horses will...
I love that concept.
Yeah.
I've never even heard of it. That's another one. What with your hair bands and now this. I'm learning yeah. stuff.
It is so great. And I went to the AAEP convention, which is a veterinary convention in, last year it was in Denver, Colorado. And I went there and helped Wendy at her booth because I had worked with my veterinarian with these radiograph blocks. And a lot of people hadn't heard of them. And they're fairly new, like a few, I would say a few years old, maybe. But it's so cool because you can actually see how these horses might open up their joint spacing because they're able to shift their weight, or how they might want to, like some, I would say, like with the Sherpa pads, a lot of the horses that I see do want to kind of dive their toe down or at least elevate their palmar angle. But I've had a few cases, and typically these are cases that have calcification or joint, or especially like joint calcification or a lot of painful issues up the limb. That's a pathology, not like a permanent pathology, you know what I mean? That will tend to, you know, I have a few that will just like dig their heels in. And I think that's because there is some restriction higher up the limb that...
But that's got to give you a pause for thought. What am I looking for now, hasn't it?
Yeah,
if
exactly.
you're seeing that.
Right, exactly. And so it's interesting to me. And so kind of leading into this, oh gosh, I could say so many things about this like long toe, low heel trim. But one thing I want to say is that, you know, there are some horses that are foundered where if you take their heels down, they just elevate those heels off the ground like a ballerina because their soft tissue is so tight. And I've had, you know, people argue with me on social media and I'm just, you know, silly. And I get into these arguments, which are pointless, honestly, but where people will say, well, we don't see that because if the hoof's in balance, they're not going to elevate that heel. And I think the truth is, in these cases, if people are leaving a long toe and they're lowering the heel, this horse doesn't have an option. They have to, they're basically forcing a stretch because the toe is keeping the heel on the ground if it's long enough. But that is so, in my experience, damaging to the soft tissue in the back half of the limb, where 100%. You're forcing them to do something that might be painful and you're not giving them an option. And you're not, you know, this is why I've started using so much of like, you know, horses standing on pads to see how they want to stand when I'm trimming, because I want to see what, you know, and it doesn't mean that I'm necessarily trimming to that, but I'm at least looking and observing to see what this horse is going to do in their natural, like if they're given the choice. Yeah, I don't know if that's I know that's a whole different other segue of standing.
Well, I'd let you trim my horse, Alicia. There you go.
Thank you. I don't know. I mean, gosh, I would love to work with all of you guys and kind of learn from all of you and see how you're trimming. Because I feel like the more I learn, and I don't know if this is universal, but the more I learn, the less I feel like I know, and the more I question every trim decision. And I feel like
it's
it should be the opposite.
Worry.
I feel like it should be the opposite, where the more I do it, the more confident I should be. And there are some things I get more confident on, but a lot of times I'm like, oh man, there's so many, you know, what ifs, or so many, you know, horses are their own creatures and they have their own, you know, feelings and also their own comfort and discomfort in their body. But yeah, something else that, well, I guess I should let any of you chime in before I change to a different, I want to talk a little bit about the biomechanics. But before I move on from that, I want to see if any of you guys want to talk a little bit more about trim. I know Robbie had some things that you had written down.
Yeah, I suppose it could move on to your next thing. I've written down things like, you know, that I don't think in all cases that a horse knows how to cure itself from laminitis. Now, in the last 28 years, as I've not wanting to advertise, but as I wrote in my book, I believe that a horse, if you kick it into the self-healing mode, then you back off because you've done your job. And it might take a lot more time than it used to with shoeing, but what you've done is create a situation where if you are giving the horse the right diet and it's able to move, then it will kick into a system that it understands. And the more that we are unable to cure ourselves, which seems to be getting more and more, you know, as humans, because we're relying on other people to do it for us, I think the more we believe we should be intervening. And it worries me a lot when I hear things like box rest, which I think should be illegal for most horses that I see, box rest, and things where you're depriving, even if the horse does know how to cure this particular problem. We've had a sarcoidosis case that nothing was happening until our horse started to move, which was advised that it shouldn't. And you realise that the gear is there; they know how to do it. It's whether we let them, and then we start to learn from them. Now, when we learn from them, we can sometimes maybe speed up the issue. But the identifying in the first place, I hate hoof testers mainly because of how they're used, not because of. So, because they're used to find out where the pain is. The only time I ever used them on a laminitic was to find out where the horse was happy to stand. I only wanted to know where the horse wasn't hurting. I'm sure as hell through my professionalism know where it is hurting.
Yeah.
So, you know, I still didn't get this idea that people are palpating over the P3 and you go, well, yeah. I kind of knew that already. And then also, of course, with cases where people are just looking for other things that are damaged, they only look at one side of a hoof tester, believing that's the side that's reading. And of course, the other one, 9 times out of 10, is aligned with the terminal lamina, but I won't go there. When I was a god, which was when I was shoeing, I realized that, you know, I'm in charge of the healing process. Well, I didn't actually cure anything. I treated loads of horses and we had great success. And another thing that I wrote down with this long toe thing, when I used the glue tube plastics, and at that time, when we're talking in the 80s, there were very, very few adhesive plastic and polymer shoes being put on. But I got into a thing called glue twos, and I was, you know, doing a lot of them, a lot being maybe 2 to 3 a week. 2 to 3 a day at the clinic, and then going away and doing sort of consultancy work and realizing there were lots of other horses who would benefit from them. But the interesting thing was, and I've noticed it with other polymers that are out there on the adhesive shoes, is that under compression, the actual polymer changes color. So we were getting a yellowing, and I thought at first it was because of maybe urine staining or horses just, you know, being in another, or the polymer being in another environment. Well, it wasn't. It was actually due to compression. And the amazing amount of these horses, even the ones early days when, God forbid, we were doing resections, we were getting discoloring in that dorsal area. The horse wanted to bear. So we started to take the plastic shoe further out. And that's when they stopped putting the pressure on and they were starting to alter the scapula. There was a load of biomechanical changes going on because the toe was going out on the plastic shoe. So we were sort of saying, okay, now we know there's a limit. This was nothing to do with them healing, because a lot of them were healing because we had done it, because the lions would have had them by now. As Matt was saying earlier, you know, we are dabbling in stuff that the horse is saying, well, over to you, because by now I would have been eaten. I'm not the fastest one in the crowd anymore. And basically, that was sort of from my notes, listening to Matt and to Mark and to you. This self-healing thing is what we're actually, all of us are fumbling around desperately trying to say in each individual horse, where with the work you're doing, with the diet that you're on, where is your self-healing ability?
And you had mentioned with the plastic shoes, were you saying that you were bringing the breakover back, or were you bringing it forward and you noticed that
We started because, if you can imagine, when resections were all the rage, God forbid, and I put my hands up to doing them, you had a very short toe on these horses. And of course, the stance improved no end. But let's all remember, folks, when a horse puts in an elaminated stance, it's telling us where it wants to stand. It isn't saying this is painful. It's saying this is the only way I'm comfortable is to stand back here. So when we come along saying, yes, but we could get you upright. Now, whether they want to be upright or not. So we've got to be careful in reading it wrong. But at that point, we were putting on very, very short-toed shoes. And then I was realizing they were still concussing them because, of course, we'd relieved a lot of the pain from the laminitic wedge, and that was if we were catching them really early and we were getting serum sort of pumping out of the front, leaving the dermal membrane, so we were actually not getting any infection, and we were getting good results. The problem with resections was you were getting medial and lateral flares for many, many, many months afterwards. But if you did a porthole and release the serum, then you weren't. But anyway, we started to take these toes out to see if and I hate to mention degrees, but if we measured what we were interpreting to be a good angle for this dorsal wall on a specific horse, we would slowly take the plastic out to that thickness. I was actually at some point sticking on bits on the toe. And there was a point when it would change the action. They put less pressure on the toe because it was too long.
Yeah.
Now, that was a square and flat toe. Then if you took them down at 45 degrees, it went back to that comfortable place again. So you can, I'm assuming, having a toe that's a foot long, as long as none of it is impeding the biomechanics of the horse at breakover.
Yeah, and that's something that I want to bring up because, you know, I feel like this conversation was sort of born out of having discussions on social media where everything that I have read and learned was being challenged without any sort of evidence. It was just, well, that doesn't work because of X, Y, and Z. So I've heard with the movement piece or the biomechanics piece is the argument that there are no lever forces on the hoof because they say horses are not people. So people have, you know, two distal limbs. We have, you know, two legs, 2 feet. And that's where the lever forces come from because you have 1 foot on the ground in movement at a time. Whereas the horse has four. And I'm literally just parroting or trying to loosely parrot what I've read and arguments that I've seen. Horses have four legs. And if they're moving, they don't have to propel themselves forward because they have the three other legs to do that. So they can pick up their limb without having any forces on the front of it or any forces on the limb in movement, which I don't know how that can even be a statement because we have, you know, tech scan studies with Dr. Jenny Hagen, and we have, you know, these biomechanics sensors with Pat Riley. We have so many different studies that show where the forces are in the hoof and in the limb in movement. And the trump card or the sort of be-all, end-all argument is from, you know, these people of following the specific trim process is that, well, of course the studies are going to show that because they didn't trim them the right way. And if they trim them the right way, the studies would be totally different. And so it's this sort of like straw man fallacy circular argument that you can't even argue with them because... And this is probably going to get a lot of flack because I know that I'm really putting my neck out there and saying how much I disagree with this, but you really can't argue because, you know, they're saying, well, you can't, you know, we're presenting, these are the studies that prove that what you're saying is incorrect. And they're saying, well, we can't even look at those studies because they didn't trim the way we do. So,
okay.
But anyway, I would love to, I would
make a statement here.
Yeah.
Can I go home now, mummy?
I think we're hitting into the crux of things. Okay. When I first started doing barefoot and things, there was an awful lot of skepticism from a lot of farriers. And did I get a bit of flack? Yes, I did. But the more open you were to say, look, I'm trying this, but I'm not sure. So rather than creating an echo chamber of yourself and learning in your own silo, and actually being open about what you're doing and trying to promote discussions, because what I was seeing, everybody else was seeing. Okay,
you create a healthy relationship with the people around you, you know. Now, my question to all this is, okay, great. Why isn't the relationship healthy with the certain group that we're busy talking about? Because right from day one, it was echo chambering about what they thought, but more importantly, it was about not what everybody else thought. So straight away, you've got from the birth of Barefoot to, you know, a lot of issues and challenges to where we're at now, where we have multitudes now of groups of people freely discussing, working together for the betterment of the horse. Okay. To me, it's a golden age. And then you get this, you know, and for me, I'm not interested. I'm not interested in what they say. I'm not interested anymore in people trying to defend what they say, because you've created your own silo, mm-hmm, where you've not welcomed anybody. Now, how does that benefit horses?
Right.
And how anybody can turn around and say, oh, well, you know, we're doing this and you guys are all wrong and we're going to save all the horses. Well, bloody good luck to that. Because a lot of people with a lot of money and a lot of people with not a lot of money work their asses off for years and years and years trying to understand the challenges of horses in domestication.
Yeah.
Now, if your group's going to turn up and just say, well, actually, by the way, we've invented the foot, mm-hmm, and actually there's no such thing as laminitis, and it's because all you guys aren't footing trim and treat properly, well, you come and speak to the 250 horses that I had that was healthy, bumming around without a care in the world, and you explain to them that I was doing it wrong. You know, and for me, we learn from the ones that are doing well, you know. We should be x-raying them, not always x-raying sick horses, because how do we know what the correct parameters are?
Right.
You know, and until we start just this irrelevant noise, just ignoring it.
Can I?
Because it takes you down the wrong rabbit hole.
Yeah.
So can I just say that it doesn't seem to be happening in many other professions, and we are in this, certainly in the UK, and now we're going to be subject to a parliamentary act going through, so there will be a different criteria for these people. But I do think being examined by your peers and having a place of excellence where these things are scientifically proven one way or another, and a chance at a place where people can go to try out these theories, right or wrong, is what we're screaming out for now because of the materials. Absolutely. We've got. And if we don't get that education into one place and then scientifically come up with a conclusive answer, we're going to get back. You know, we're still dabbling in back in the days when the dentist was on the village green pulling out teeth with a piece of string. And we've got to get somehow a place of excellence in I'm talking the UK now, a place of excellence and peer pressure of saying, look, you know, you've got to prove the science behind this. And then all of us will be coming under some scrutiny, which we owe to the horse. End of rant.
Yeah.
I've got a little bit to say, actually.
Yeah.
In the absence of what Robbie was just talking about, so we don't have this centre of excellence at the moment, but what we do have is the horse. So if we're talking specifically lever forces, when we talk locomotion, what about stance? What about in stance? So at stance, if the horse wants to sleep standing up, the subcarpal check ligament forms part, just one part of the stay apparatus. Now, the only way the horse can engage the subcarpal check ligament as part of its stay apparatus in order to rest is if it can subtly lean forward into its body. Otherwise, that subcarpal check ligament does not come under any kind of tension. Therefore, the only option for that horse, if its toes are too long, if the hoof capsule is deformed away from its normal parameters, you deny that horse the ability to rest properly. It has to sleep lying down. It cannot sleep standing up. It will also be looking for places where it can dig the substrate up. So if it's in the box, it'll box walk, it'll dig until it can get its feet into such a position which will allow that to happen. So that's an observation we can make of the horse in that department. Then when we start to get into dissection, when we start to take off the hoof capsules of these deformed feet, we very quickly begin to see at the maximum crimping point of that hoof wall, the underlying laminae is anemic. It is physically squeezed. There is no blood flow going through it, and it becomes a chronic condition. So the laminae go from being a nice pink, healthy colour to being white. And then we've got the long-term deformation of P3 itself. So the pedal bone is subject to the forces of gravity and the forces of leverage within the hoof capsule. So without any science at all, we can observe things within the horse itself, you know, as to indicators as what this is actually doing and causing. So, you know, that's something to be borne in mind.
No, yeah. Good point.
Yeah. And this is a little off topic, but one thing I do want to say, going back to a little bit about, you know, the differences in opinions and mentalities in hoof care methodologies, is that I, for one, would be much more open to trying really anything that might help the horse, even if it seems like it's wild and out there, if it's not presented in a way that's attacking others or saying that others, everybody else is wrong and this is the only right way. I'm less inclined to want to try that and more inclined to become defensive on what we, you know in other studies, research instances. And I think that is the downfall of a lot of these sort of like, oh, one guru methods, is that they're coming off in such a way that's not inviting others to, like we're talking about, to discuss or to have an open mind or an open conversation. You know, I'm very willing to try anything that I think is going to help the horse if I don't think the welfare is going to be compromised. But yeah, if you get to the point where it's just becoming like a yelling match, that's not something that is going to.
It's not
to
good, but help. like also as well, what starts all this? You know, these are, you know, this is a business model we're talking about here.
Yeah,
you know, business models. It is about horses, but it's not. It's a business model using horses, is what it is. You know, I reached out a long time ago saying, "Look, love what you're doing. It's absolutely fantastic. The format, everything. It's really easy to read and it was easy to understand and it was nice." But there was just this undercurrent of anger and nastiness. And it's like, just change the tone.
Yeah.
And then you just got dogs with abuse back. It's like, oh, well, okay. I'm not gonna look at you guys' stuff, you know? And then it's escalating. What I feel sorry for in amongst all this, and this is something that we really have to think long and hard about, okay, is we've got people trapped in this cycle. We've got horses potentially suffering in this cycle, you know, but the business model's created in such a way as, how do you get out of it? You know,
yeah.
You know, we can't be running around condemning all the time, you know, otherwise we don't move forward. Creating division, there's too much division in this world at the moment, you know, and you actually get the root cause, you put everybody in a room. There's more in common than what there is than division, you know. We have to hold on to that sort of stuff. But then for it to start turning around and getting angry back and shouting about a horse that is so dynamically complex, you know, that is dynamically complex from where it lives, its birth, its upbringing, its development, it's all this sort of stuff. It's just noise, you know. One size will never fit all, which is why none of us can sit down in here. Oh, you've got a laminitic. This is what you must do. You know? Do you know what I mean? Because there's always that one thing that we're missing. Now, I'd rather have 10, 20 heads in that room trying to work that out than sitting there with the ego head on going, it's all right, because I can fix this. This is not a problem. And then when it goes wrong, start blaming other stuff.
Yeah.
You know? I didn't sign up for that. Nobody. Honestly, I have met a few, but there's not many folks signed up for that nonsense. You know,
yeah,
just, and it is nonsense.
And I won't say, you know, I don't think it's wrong to question our research and to question what we believe to be true. I think it's good to question what is commonplace and what is, you know, what everybody's doing now, especially if there are still cases that are failing, quote unquote, under other methods. I think it's important to question that and important to challenge it if it's in an open mind way. You know, I absolutely love, like, I went to, in 2020, right before COVID, I went to California to Epona Mind. Monique Craig is wonderful. They make the Epona shoes. And they do a lot of research and they take so many radiographs. And they're, I think something that one of you had mentioned earlier is, you know, taking radiographs on healthy feet. And what I really like about what they're doing is they're building a database of so many different variations of what horses can look like on radiographs and what's common versus what's normal versus what, you know, do we know what's healthy versus what's common? And I think it's really cool to see a lot of their research. And that sort of has challenged me to say, similar to what I think the start of maybe what this group was getting at, is that just because it's common doesn't mean that it's right. And just because a horse commonly moves this way doesn't mean it's right. And just because the hoof commonly looks this way doesn't mean that it's right. I think that that's not a bad question to ask. And I think instead it's how we ask it and how we approach it and how we discuss it. And ultimately it has to be in a way that we're able to be open-minded and have a discussion that's civil. Yeah, and I guess that's my little soapbox on that, because I think
that doesn't make money, does it? It doesn't fit within the business model,
right? You know, unfortunately,
like you say, I have no skin in the game. I don't mind saying these things because that's what it looks like, you know. And if that's not what it looks like, then change the tone. You know. Hi guys, we've come across this. It's working for a bunch of horses. Do you want to get on board? And well, this is what we think. What do you think? You know, I mean, Mark sat and worked out how this long tour could potentially help horses at a point in time. That's the important bit, at a point in time.
And I don't think I want to use the word help, because I do believe that proactive farriery is superior.
It creates something that's different. But
it creates,
we're more than happy to sit and slag off and point fingers and things like that. But it's right, okay. Okay, the silent voice is saying, well, there's some different results here. Okay, well let's look at this and let's have a wee think of how that may or may not happen. You know, I mean, that's science, Mark. That is what we do. You know, and what was it? Was the guy down in Oxford used to teach quantum physics 20-odd years? First year student proved his theory wrong. Place goes quiet. The flipping professor gets down, goes and shakes his hand. Thank you. Now I can teach something different. Uh-huh. You know, that's where we all should be at. You know, yeah. Something's bad, come along the road, fuck, and pick it up and run with it. You know,
yeah,
it's great. Yeah. But don't do it in such a way that you alienate people, you know, and then start throwing blame, because there's a lot of people with hurt bodies that have worked a long time trying to help these guys and look after these horses. You know, and it's just wrong to dismiss people that have worked hard in this industry, you know?
Right. And I don't think that anybody, and I say this so many times on the podcast, is I don't think that anybody's waking up in the morning saying, man, I just can't wait to harm some horses today, or, you know, or make them lame today.
Absolutely.
I think what I've come across, certainly when I was shoeing, people were coming up with some weird and wonderful shoes. And like you've just said, you know, they didn't wake up saying, I want to make a shoe that's not going to be any good. Mm-hmm. But they nevertheless, we're very much into, we get one horse, you know, and we get it right. And that's the system now that should be taught and in some cases, products that are produced on very few horses being corrected. And as Matthew says, you know, I mean, every horse is different. What I hate is, in any form of life, but especially around an animal, is arrogance. And it's something, to me, you leave at the door. If you're an arrogant person, the sad part is that, you know, you start to believe everything that you've decided is right, and then you start to preach it to others. And, you know, if you surround yourself, and we know now throughout the world at the moment, but certainly a certain side of the pond. If you surround yourself with yes people, you know, you're going to start to believe everything. Every idea you have is right, whether it's how to sort out a pool in front of your house or build a new ballroom or whatever it is. But you're going to get enough people saying, yeah, you know, great idea, sir. And you'll get that with people that start to say, this works. And you ask why it worked. Well, they got it right on one horse. And it scares the hell out of me when, you know, when I used to get, and I'm sure the other two guys on this will have come across shoes in their history. I mean, certainly in my longevity, the horses, the shoes I was taking off, I would sit and look at and think, in what planet were they on when they thought putting this on the bottom of a horse's foot was a good idea? Now, you actually would have loved to have had that conversation with them. But like Matthew says, you know, you wouldn't have fallen out over it. You want to know genuinely what was in their mind. Because if you said, Alicia, they didn't put it on thinking it was going to harm it.
Right.
To the extent that I've offered to stand up in court against a farrier who luckily settled out of court because he killed a horse with his shoe. Mm-hmm. And the thing was, it was only through ignorance he killed it. But the vet, you know, was the one who actually got the blame in the end because it was a referral. And if the vet deems in law that the person was capable of doing it, it's their lookout. But nevertheless, you know, this was total ignorance. But never, you know, we didn't fall out of it. We had a heated discussion about it, maybe, but and the farrier promised he'd never do it again, which was a godsend.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, when there have been things that I didn't understand in hoof care, I've really tried to go and learn more about them so I can either have an intelligent conversation about it or at least see where they're coming from. I mean, I've had the same thing, yeah. You know, the first time I saw a backward shoe, I'm like, oh my goodness, how stupid do you have to be to do that? And then I shadowed some farriers that were doing it and they explained why they were, you know, they're like, well, we feel like we don't have anywhere to put the break over and you can't put it under the sole because they're too painful. And, you know, they're working within the confines of what their toolbox is allowing them to do in the best, you know, it's nobody's doing this because they think it's harmful, you know, or like, you know, I've seen farriers put on all kinds of shoe packages that I think are in my mind crazy. And then when I hear them discuss it, I can start to see their goal and their concept. And
which is that surely that is the same as the organization we're sort of dancing around. That is their belief that, you know, they're saying what they're doing is right. And we had a doctor lady who brought out a system of trimming many, many years ago over here, which was crippling horses, but people who were doing it were able technically to say why they were doing what they were doing.
Right. And I think that it's what I found valuable is at least able to understand the goal and the concept, even if I disagree. And I think that there's a different mindset, like you're talking about, there are these methodologies that say, well, I'm sort of turning a blind eye to the ones that aren't comfortable because I know that this is what the horse, quote unquote, needs to be healed or whatever is their thought process. But I've worked with or I've shadowed a lot of farriers who I can understand their goal. And once I understand the goal, it becomes less of like an enemy and more of a collaboration sort of discussion of, well, how could that be done in different ways? Or how could I do that? Because I don't apply shoes. I mean, I have one horse that I now have in composite glue on shoeing. I used to have a lot more, but I've slowly worked away from that. How can I do that same sort of concept and goal without shoes, with barefoot, with boots, with, you know, environment, whatever?
the difficulty with the equine world is that, you know, anything that we're doing with our hands, applying to a foot and things like that, it's a form of expression. You know, it's an art form. You know, so to be comfortable and confident for it to turn around and say, right, can you just mark this? See what you think. Now, it's interesting, Robbie's talking about having a center of excellence where everybody can go to, you know, and that would be the goal, because what we've now got is people within their environments working. And the more they do something, it becomes a belief system because they're not seeing any issues with it. But what we're not questioning is the horse is tolerating if it's negative over a period of time, and then the horse will fail. And then what will happen is some, you know, it gets referred and all the rest of it. But the biggest challenge with all of this is, you know, getting past this, what I'm doing to this foot is an expression of me. It's a kind of art form. So therefore, if you see anything about this, you're directly attacking me. You know, and I know lots of farriers that just aren't like that, but I've met plenty that are like that. You go take a horse out, you have a look at its feet, what are you looking at? You know what I mean? You know, and straight away you're into that, I'm just having a look. You know, I'm wanting to learn, I'm wanting to see how you do things, you know? And it's until this wretched ego gets toned down a bit and that we get back to this mindfulness of, okay, let us all learn, where's everybody at through your experience? Bring it all together and then say, right, can somebody test this? You know? But having a multifaceted group of folk just saying, right, okay, this is what I think, this is what I think, and putting it together. And in amongst that, the nuggets are going to be there, you know? But again, what we're doing is we're all trying to reinvent the foot. Mm-hmm. You know? A healthy horse kicking about where it has free will and all the rest of it will have a healthy foot, you know? So when we drag it in and we take our knife to it, before you start carving it up based on what your perceptions of what it should look like, can we not start just observing where the horse is at and seeing where that differs from horses that don't have those environments? You know, it's not difficult, you know?
Yeah, and something that's that... No, I agree. And then, you know, something that Daisy Bicking told me back, I think it was 7 years ago, I went to a clinic at her farm and she said, or something she didn't tell me, she said to the whole group, are horses getting better because of what we're doing or in spite of what we're doing? And that's something that sort of kicked me in the gut of like, you know, I have some cases that maybe are struggling. I have a lot of cases that do well, but are the cases that are doing well, I just assume that because I did this trim and this management and the horse is better, is that because of this trim and this management? Or is it because this horse is healing on its own or resilient, or they have, you know, some other factors
What I was saying about the natural healing, as far as I'm concerned, is that the most sort of joyous moment is when you've done the minimum amount of interference and that's what the horse needed to start the self-healing process. Yeah. And you see the result, you see the caudal third getting stronger, or whatever it is you're trying to achieve. And you realize, you know, within that 4 week period between trims, or the horse has said, yep, that's what I needed in order to kick in. And sometimes it's not doing a trim, it's saying to the owner, would you please just take this horse for a walk once a day? Could you change its diet? Could you not box rest it? Whatever it is. And if you've started off, I mean, I keep saying to owners, you know, that I'm still going to charge if I don't touch your horse, because if I go to the dentist and he said, you've really looked after your teeth well and you don't need anything, I would actually probably pay him another £10 for saying that, because he's not going to open my mouth and start filling it with, you know, equipment. And I feel the same as a trimmer. If I turn up and say, you're doing such a great job, you're exercising the horse right, you're feeding it right, you're giving it the right conditions, and you might be just cleaning up the edges of the feet, they never question the fact that I'm still going to charge for my time and visit, because the professionalism has lent to a sound horse.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think, Alicia, when you're questioning this, you know, is it the intervention or is it not? If you've battled along a certain way trying to get a result, and then finally, I mean, I'm speaking from personal experience, you're trying to get a hoof to develop, you're trying to help a horse, and you keep going down that barefoot route, and then you think, okay, right, let's make a change. And so I do intervene with some composites. I've had it happen on multiple occasions now where you just break the cycle for the horse. You introduce a different level of comfort, a different level of proprioception. And all of a sudden, because that horse is feeling better, you've changed that level of comfort. It's then able to respond. So I think we're back to this thing about it's just not clear cut at the end of the day, you know. But certainly, if you've had a horse consistently where you've been trying consistently to do something, and then you introduce a change and the horse improves, there's your answer.
Yeah, totally.
And I think too, though, I say that. That question, the is the horse better because of what we're doing or in spite of what we're doing? Because I think also we can apply that to different trim methodologies too. You know, there's this group that says, well, because this horse is better and I have a long toe and a low heel, that is what made them better. And my thought is, well, okay, maybe is the horse better because of what they're doing or in spite of what they're doing? And what other changes have there been in that horse's life and management? And so I think it's definitely important. Like, I still ask myself that a lot, especially if there's something that works for one horse and doesn't work for another. My question is, okay, in these two instances, which one is the one that's better or worse in spite of me or because of me, you know, or because of management or anything else. But I think that it's also important when we're looking at other cases where we see people saying, well, this happened, that I did this, and now this horse is sound, everyone should do this. That question does become more significant of, okay, well, was it because of what you did or in spite of what you did?
Yeah.
You know.
That's another, probably another amazing conversation to be had, too. Sadly, I'm going to have to end mine.
I have to head out, too. So.
Yeah, I'm running late now as well.
I'm sorry.
When to kind of jump in, but yeah.
No.
It's a good conversation, guys, you know, but. You know, at the end of the day, you know, we just got to respect each other and where we're at and help each other in the journey, you know. There's just no place for this malice, you know, and that's all it is. And it's really sad because, you know, it's just spoiling it for themselves, aren't they?
So, yeah. Well, thank you all so much. I so appreciate your time. I'm sorry if you're running late today.
No, I've enjoyed every minute.
Have a good rest
of your day. Take care, Alicia. Thanks very much. Take care, Alicia, for organizing it all. Thanks a lot.
Oh, of course.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Alicia. Take care now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I always say that I'm slightly more hoof-obsessed than the average person, and chances are, if you're listening to a hoof care podcast, you are too, so we should probably be friends. Feel free to find me on Facebook or email me at thehumblehoof@gmail.com.